I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. Pandora personalizes the radio experience for listeners by playing songs that sound similar to the artist or song that a listener enters on their computer, iPhone, or in the car. Tim started Pandora in 2000, and the company made its first profit 10 years later at the end of 2009. Pandora went public in June 2011. Pandora is based on the Music Genome Project, a system that analyzes each song based on approximately 400 musical attributes, including harmony, instruments, or the nature of the artist's voice. Pandora has a team of musicologists who interpret each song and populate listeners' personalized radio stations with songs that they might like. Tim is a jazz pianist who has also played the clarinet, drums, and bassoon. Tim played in rock bands and composed music for movies prior to starting Pandora. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You graduated from Stanford in 1988, and for the next 12 years, you had a career as a musician. What were your aspirations fresh out of college?
Well, I wanted to be a rock star. That was my dream when I graduated. I didn't really know how I was going to get there, but I really left college with a real passion for music.
So even though you were trained as a jazz pianist, you wanted to be a rock star.
Yeah, jazz was really how I learned sort of harmony and theory and the piano. But as a composer and as a performer, my passion has always been for sort of rock pop music.
And who were some of your favorite, you know, rock artists whom you wish to emulate or become?
Well, it's changed over time. It's certainly the Beatles are my taproot. I love just about everything they've done, and they've been a real inspiration for me. I was a big Steely Dan fan for a long time as well. Mm-hmm. But I like everything from, you know, Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder to Fleetwood Mac to Ben Folds. Oscar Peterson's my favorite jazz musician. A pretty broad range of things.
Did you come from a house filled with music?
I came from a house full of tone-deaf people, so not a lot of musical background around me.
So how did your parents go about introducing you to the piano?
Well, it was pretty simple. I actually was living in France at the time, and I was interested in music. I took to it in school, and they just bought a piano for me. And I took some lessons from a blues pianist in Paris, and I really just took to it and started kind of teaching myself.
You had a nomadic childhood. You lived in France for a little while. Where else did you live, and what brought you to these places?
Yeah, well, I moved to France when I was 6. I lived there till I was 12, and then we moved to England, where I lived for 4 years, then went back to school in Michigan for a couple years before heading to California for college. And we moved because my dad was a businessman who worked mostly in North Africa and the Middle East and was always headquartered in Europe. He was in foods and pharmaceuticals.
You had this aspiration to become a rock star. What did you do logistically when you graduated from Stanford?
Well, the first couple of years, I actually really woodshed it as a piano player. I played piano 6-7 hours a day, really trying to hone my performing skills, and kind of gradually segued into playing with groups. So I was always a composer. I was always writing music, but I began kind of in my mid-20s playing live, and eventually I think poured most of my energy into bands, began to tour, did recordings, and really kind of lived out of a van for a while, did the whole sort of independent working musicians thing. It was certainly not something a lot of my friends and peers were doing. I think it was exciting and fun and interesting, but I think as the years went by, you certainly develop a growing sense of apprehension about whether it's going to lead anywhere.
And certainly graduating from Stanford, you could have become a consultant.
Yeah. This was not the most common career choice for my fellow graduates, for sure. And that lasted, gosh, until I was about 30. And then I kind of grew tired of the band dynamics, the sort of logistics of being one of many in a band, and became a film composer for a while.
How did you support yourself during this time? Did you make enough money composing these films or commercials?
I just about made a living doing that. I had a series of odd jobs in my 20s. I was a nanny for a while. I worked in administration at a medical school, a bunch of kind of very typical sort of musician gigs.
I don't think a nanny is a traditional musician gig for a guy.
That's true. It's not atypical for a musician. I think a lot of people are involved in that. But I did. I even played piano, you know, in hotel lobbies and things like that.
The idea for the Music Genome Project, which really is the infrastructure for Pandora, came out of your work as a composer for film. Can you describe that a little bit?
So there were really two inspirations for the genome. The genome itself definitely came from my experience as a film composer. And what happens when you're a film composer is your job is sort of twofold. One is to really be able to craft music for a certain effect, so to support picture, a scene or an emotion, a mood, whatnot. That's number one. And number two is to satisfy a director. So I got very accustomed to thinking about music and music taste in terms of musical attributes, which I think is something we all do to a greater or lesser degree. And one day I had this idea, because I'd gotten pretty good at figuring out what a director wanted. I actually would put them through kind of this musical interview, sort of the equivalent of a musical Myers-Briggs test, where I would play music for them and get their feedback and kind of glean from their answers what they wanted. And I realized that what I was doing was this genome in my head. And the idea just popped into my brain one day that, gosh, if I could codify this, write this all down, there might be a way for technology to marry it with technology to build a recommendation technology.
Incidentally, when was the Human Genome Project? Was it around this time? In 2000?
Well, I did some work actually at Stanford in the medical school for a while, and there was a lot of work being done on the human genome, so that was in my head too. But it was probably 5 years old at that point, maybe.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. At what point did this become more than just an intellectual idea where you said, you know what, I think I might have a business here?
Well, the idea percolated in my head for a few months. My wife was very supportive of it. And then one day what happened was I shared the idea with a friend of mine who had already had sort of a successful entrepreneurial experience. And his name was John Kraft. And so he said, you know, why don't we just go ahead and do it? Let's just do it. And it sort of happened suddenly after that.
What part of your shift was the acknowledgement that you were not trending towards becoming, you know, John Williams, the famous, you know, film composer, versus, you know what, I'm really psyched about this project and I'm going to take agency and make it happen?
Well, I was making sort of slow and steady progress as a film composer. But like I think virtually every musical profession, it's very hard to know if you're headed towards a good, healthy, long-term career or not. And you know, you spend most of your time really grinding away, trying to build your business, and you kind of take two steps forward, one step back. I was encouraged by where it was going, but I didn't sort of see an obvious path to a career there. But I think what really caused me to make this shift was kind of a few things. One, I really thought the idea was a good one. And there was, at the time, a tremendous amount of excitement and energy on the web in the music space. And it held this incredible promise for, you know, for changing the music industry. And this idea fit right into it. And the second thing was, I was living in the Bay Area, so I was surrounded by this kind of almost, you know, irrational exuberance for entrepreneurship. So many people were starting businesses, and there was so much investment capital around looking to fund these businesses that it was one of those windows where, you know, if you were ever going to do it, that was the time.
Can you sum up what the Music Genome Project is?
So the genome itself is a musical taxonomy. So it's a collection of attributes, and there are about 400, that collectively describe a song. So every dimension of a recording, whether it's melody, harmony, rhythm, form, instrumentation, the vocal performance, etc., each one of those aspects is broken down into a collection of attributes, kind of like musical primary colors. Mm-hmm. So the voice has about 15 attributes just dedicated to understanding what the voice sounds like. And the idea is that you can describe just about any piece of music along the same set of attributes by just giving them different scores. It's like musical DNA.
it's people, not computers, who are kind of behind the Music Genome Project, who are looking at a piece of music and taking 20 minutes per song and analyzing it. What was your thought behind using people versus, let's say, computers to make it happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it was our single biggest liability when we started, because everybody thought this was completely insane, that we'd have a team of people analyzing songs. And you're right, it can take upwards of 15, 20 minutes, as much as an hour and a half in the case of a symphony, to complete an analysis. And the reason we did it that way was that's really the only way to do it. Machines don't have the capability of extracting that kind of data from a sound file. And the other methods for, you know, connecting songs didn't solve what was for me the most important problem, which was how to surface the stuff you've never heard before. And that's kind of where my first experience as a performer came into play, because I was really interested in finding a way for technology to help the sort of working musician, you know, the person who wasn't on radio and didn't have a record deal. And the beauty of the genome is that it's completely blind to popularity. Mm-hmm. So we're just as adept at recommending a song from a garage band as we are from a hit artist.
I also feel like having people involved gives the Music Genome Project some heart or some subjective judgment in a way that, just having 400 criteria doesn't sound very, you know, warm and fuzzy.
Well, you know, we actually think about Pandora literally inside the company as a human being trying to figure out what you want and converse with you the same way a friend would, you know, that friend we all hope we have who knows your music taste and has this encyclopedic knowledge of music.
What is the background of the musicologists or the people, you know, behind the scenes who suggesting the music?
So they're all trained musicians. You need to have at least an undergraduate degree in music theory or equivalent to do this kind of analysis. Many of them have advanced degrees, and they're all essentially working musicians. This is their day job. They're in bands. Many of them teach. They perform. There are pianists and drummers and guitarists and people who play washboard and singers and, you know, everything in between.
It's kind of akin to the slow food movement, where it does take more time to collect data for each song, and you might have fewer songs in your library versus, you know, some of your competitors.
I like that that metaphor. It's the slow food of music. Like that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. The company went public in June 2011. We'll hear more from Tim coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. Pandora personalizes the radio experience for listeners by playing songs that sound similar to the artist or song that a listener enters on their computer, iPhone, or in the car. Tim started Pandora in 2000, and the company made its first profit 10 years later at the end of 2009. Pandora went public in June 2011. Tim is a jazz pianist who also has played the clarinet, drums, and bassoon. Tim played in rock bands and composed music for movies prior to starting Pandora. You mentioned before how capital was coming easily to entrepreneurs in the Bay Area, and that was one of the impetuses for, you know, maybe starting your own company. The culture felt right. How easily did capital come to you when you were first launching Pandora?
So the first round of financing came relatively quickly from a small group of angel investors. It was about $1.5 million that got us off the ground, and that lasted about a year, and then it got awfully tough. We spent a number of years unable to raise money and spent a good part of that working for free and had to kind of hang on until the sort of the valley rose again in 2004 to raise a big round of investment.
It wasn't until 2004 when Larry Marcus, who was at Walden Ventures, they invested $9 million in Pandora. Is there a story of that first meeting?
Yeah, well, Larry was certainly my knight in shining armor. He actually had been following our company for a number of years, had seen us several times. And I think he's a drummer, a musician, and someone who's got a real passion for music and the sort of digital music arena. He's an investor who has long wanted to be part of this space. I think he liked the idea, and he believed that the Music Genome Project was going to have its day. And I think he also appreciated the tenacity of the team.
How different was the company that you started? How different is it from the company that it's become? I mean, some things have changed. Like, you started out with a subscription-based revenue model. Now you make most of your capital from advertising, for example. What were some other changes made?
Yeah, well, I think that this company is kind of a combination of very much the same company it was when it started. I think, the core of Pandora remains the Music Genome Project and the mission of the company, which is to help people discover music and to help bands find their audiences, has really not changed since the beginning. The front end of that mission has changed dramatically, of course. We went from being sort of a technology provider in the early years, including building kiosks for record stores, into a consumer-facing website. And as you said, we started briefly as a subscription business only, and then within a matter of weeks offered a free version of Pandora. There remains a subscription option as well. But we now look at this business as being about free advertising support to consumers.
Your name also changed. You were Savage Beast Technologies. Where'd that come from?
It comes from a Frost poem, William Congreve poem, "Music hath charms to soothe the savage beast." It's what? Actually to soothe the savage breast.
It's just a misspelling.
Yeah. That would have had different implications for the company.
How did you ultimately decide on Pandora?
Well, the name, the idea came from our CEO, Joe Kennedy. And we had been through kind of a very typical process of trying to find a name for the company. And when he suggested that name, it was one of those moments when we all said, that just sounds perfect. Mm-hmm. It's the story of Pandora is about this box that, she's so curious she can't help but open. And it's full of surprises. Granted, not the kind of surprises we're trying to provide people. But we love that she is insatiably curious and that you don't know what's going to come out of the box when you open it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. I want to switch gears a little bit. Songs on Pandora are suggested by not so much the wisdom of crowds or what the crowd thinks or what's most popular, but by the actual physical construct of a song. Why are you so opposed to, what's kind of popular these days, the wisdom of crowds and the community having a word in helping to form musical preferences?
So I wouldn't say that I'm opposed to it. And we actually do use our own version of collaborative filtering or kind of wisdom of the crowds in the way we interpret the thumbs up and thumbs down that people give us.
Uh-huh.
So when you thumb up or thumb down a song on Pandora, it curates your station in real time just for you. But we also collect the aggregate thumbs up and thumbs down for every song, for every station on which it plays. And we actually do use that now to help us shape stations. So
okay. It
is a piece of the puzzle. But I think the heart of your question around, why we approach this from the Music Genome Project standpoint is that, it's the one system that can really effectively surface stuff that you've never heard of before, that has no purchasing history or preference history that a collaborative filtering engine just can't grapple with. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the seminal problem of music. It always has been. It's the problem for artists as well. And I was in and among these working musicians for a long time. And the problem is, how do you sort of get noticed? And the idea behind the Genome Project was it would be the one place that was truly a level playing field, where when you came into Pandora, once you were on the system, your chance of playing was really about your sound and nothing to do with how popular you were.
You do allow musicians who are not necessarily recognized by the public or don't have record labels to upload their music and to be offered on Pandora.
We encourage it. The only prerequisite. There are two prerequisites for playing on Pandora. One is that your music is good, and that's an editorial decision that we make. And the second one is it has to be available for sale on Amazon, and that's a function of kind of how we track content on Pandora through UPC codes, etc. But really, anybody can submit their music, and you do it online through a digital process. It all gets listened to, and we pick the best stuff, regardless of you know, is the band young or old or successful or not or on a label or not or cool or not? You know, that's just not a factor. And so you'll never see Pandora, you know, cop an attitude about music. And I think, you know, partly that comes from, you know, our own musical background. You know, as a musician myself, I know how hard it is to write good music, no matter what kind. So I have a real respect for just, you know, just about anything, whether it's the most kind of packaged pop tune or some very, very atonal modern classical music. I have a sense of what goes into it, and I think we have a profound respect for that.
Pandora may not have an attitude about, you know, about music, but certainly your listeners do. Do you have an example of some criticism that your listeners might have offered you because you're not part of this popularity contest?
We do get periodic objections from people about music that we play on their stations, for sure. Some people get very offended when we select certain artists and pair them with artists that they love, and they feel somehow insulted because they think that suggestion is uncool.
What's an example?
My favorite one is an example I got from someone who had heard a Celine Dion song on a Sarah McLachlan station. I will never forget, who was very upset about it and felt that it was just, you know, very uncool for us to pair those two. But after some back and forth, they kind of really looked past the sort of cultural label and realized, well, you know, musically it kind of makes sense and I like it. It took a while for them to acknowledge that, but it was a really happy ending. As a musician, nothing drives me crazier than music snobbery. You know, it's hard enough as it is for musicians to make a living, and the last thing that they need on top of everything is to deal with, you know, people who think once they've got some degree of commercial success, they've somehow sold out and aren't worthy anymore.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. The company didn't make a profit until almost 2010. Can you talk to me about sort of the psychology of somebody who's working for 10 years and not making any money?
And I know it's pretty damaged. it's tired. Psychology is. I think that we had an incredible group of employees. I mean, really a remarkable group, both in terms of their sort of skills and talent, and also their tenacity and loyalty to the project. And I think that people never stopped believing in the basic idea. I think everyone who saw the music genome in operation and got to kind of play with the demo we had built thought it was really powerful, and that we just had lousy timing and needed to hang on long enough for it to see its day, which I think has borne out. But I think that when you go that long in such adversity, you know, there are a whole bunch of things that come into play, and probably more than anything, it's a sense of camaraderie and loyalty to each other, as much as anything that keeps you going.
Is there a loneliness at all, especially being, the founder?
Yeah, probably the most challenging part of it is you don't know if and when it's going to ever end, and you know you're climbing a hill, but you just can never see the top, and you have no idea where it is, and that can be very discouraging. But I think if you're one of the leaders of that mission, you just don't have the choice. You know, you need to lead by example. You need to stay positive and respect the kind of sacrifice that people around you have made on your urging,
yeah.
For so long. So you don't, in some ways, you don't really have the luxury of dwelling on the downside.
Were there ever points in that 10-year period where you thought of doing something else?
Not really. I mean, there were many times when I was, you know, very afraid that this was all going to wind up as a big smoking hole in the ground, and that a lot of people were going to be let down. I lived with that fear for a long time, but never thought I'd just stop. You know?
And you had an experience in 2007 where you were on the verge of bankruptcy, but it did confirm the loyalty of your listeners when royalty rates for playing songs increased, I think it was by the Federal Royalty Board. And with the help of a lobbyist, you really got your users on board to write letters to Congress to have the prices lowered. Talk to me a little bit about the details of that experience.
Yeah, so we went through this period of time where a ruling from the Copyright Royalty Board, which is part of the Copyright Office in Washington, essentially broke our business and broke business for internet radio, period. And in order to sort of solve that, we turned to our listeners and organized a grassroots political campaign. It was essentially asking people to call their member of Congress and object, you know, protest this and demand some kind of relief. And it was an incredible, incredible outpouring of support. It was so large and so constant that Congress actually intervened to help solve the problem, which is a really rare thing.
Despite the fact that you weren't earning significant revenue or making a profit in those 10 years, you had fierce loyalty among your employees. What's an example of that?
Years ago, when we were in some of our lowest of lows, one of our engineers who had been with us for a number of years and had been, you know, working without salary for a long time, came up to Will, our then CTO, and said, "You know, I can't come to work tomorrow. I can't afford the BART ride into work. I just literally have no money left." And Will gave him $20 so that he'd come in another day. I think he wound up figuring out a way to keep working, but we were scraping the bottom of the barrel for a while.
Pandora had a turning point in 2008 with the iPhone, and the number of users increased to 35,000 users a day because there was a Pandora app offered on the iPhone. Even though you had played a role in setting this up, were you yourself surprised by the meteoric rise of adoption?
Yeah, I think we were all pretty taken aback by the velocity of that, of the mobile growth, which continues unabated now. I think there were two parts of it that surprised us and pleased us. One was just the raw increase in growth, and it almost doubled our growth rate overnight. But I think probably more importantly, it redefined our category because people began taking these devices, these mobile devices, and listening to Pandora in lots of places other than the office, which is where we had principally been listened to. So, you know, they'd take it to the gym or plug it into their car dashboard or dock it at home and stream Pandora through their stereo system. And so it was almost like overnight we went from being a sort of an at-work desktop, you know, computer radio product to something more akin to radio writ large, and we were available anytime, anywhere. And that really is the story of Pandora right now. I mean, we are a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day habit.
Now Pandora is enjoying a successful period after 10 years of really a forced march. How does it feel for you? Like, do you have an example of what that feels like?
Yeah, so I frequently have sort of out-of-body experiences now where having been, you know, in such a troubled times for so long, I often sort of pinch myself, and that happens to me fairly frequently now. One in particular, I was at an event where Joe and I were being hosted by a Wall Street investment bank who was looking to win our business so that they could facilitate a big financing round that we were doing. So we were being courted by investors, essentially, and I was at this very fancy event in Las Vegas and sitting next to this buffet table holding a truffle-infused Kobe beef burger and a very expensive glass of red wine, wondering, you know, what the hell I was doing here. And it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I remember thinking that the clock was going to strike 12 and something weird was going to happen. I was going to wind up, you know, holding a Coke and a Big Mac or being back you know, back at home, sweating over the company's future. And I really did sometimes wonder if I was in a dream, was going to wake up. That happens a lot.
You are running a multi-million dollar business now. How much interaction do you have with your listeners?
So we actually decided from day one that we were going to take advantage of every opportunity to converse with people that were using Pandora, no matter what they had to say, whether it was a critique or a love letter and everything in between. And so we literally answer every single email that we get, and we get tens of thousands of them every month. And we have a team of people whose only job is just to do that. So we talk all the time with listeners.
What's the nature of some of those emails?
The emails range from you know, constructive criticism about the website to personal stories about having a baby born to Pandora, or, you know, someone who runs a funeral parlor and uses Pandora as a soundtrack, or, you know, bands people have discovered and gone to see, or, you know, ways they think we should improve the site. It's this whole, this incredible litany of advice, anecdotes, criticisms, hate mail, love letters. People send us brownies. People write music for us. It's incredible. A listener wrote in recently. Her father had just passed away, and in the sort of waning months of his life, when he was at the hospital, they had discovered Pandora and had introduced him to it, and it had apparently provided him a great amount of sort of relief and joy, you know, in the final months of his life. And he passed away listening to Pandora. And the listener wrote in just to sort of say thank you and to tell us what about this and how much it meant to her. And you know, because we know, you know, when someone dies, a hospital can give you the time of death. We were able to figure out what song was playing when he died, and we let her know what that was, and sent her a CD of it, and she played it at his funeral. That was a pretty humbling exchange to have with someone, but it's, you know, music is just such this powerful thing.
What was the song?
I think it was Vivaldi. I need to go look it up. I think it was Vivaldi.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my distinct pleasure.
My guest has been Tim Westergren, founder of Pandora. Coming up, we'll meet Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India. Planet Read adds subtitling to songs on TV programs in the same language as the audio, so people can read the words as they are sung. Same language subtitling, or SLS, first appeared in 1999 in the Indian state of Gujarat on a 30-minute program of film songs. And now the service is available to 300 million viewers on a weekly basis. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off with your personal history. You grew up in a town on the southern eastern coast of India called Pondicherry. There's an ashram in the center of the town. What role did the ashram play in your life?
Typically, when you think of an ashram in India, you think of people meditating, doing yoga, on a totally spiritual journey. But the Aurobindo Ashram is also very unusual in the sense that actually it emphasizes a lot of sports. So physical education is very important. The other interesting thing about the Aurobindo Ashram was that there are no exams in the schools. So I went from kindergarten till college in one sweep without ever having taken a single exam.
How is your knowledge tested without an exam?
So the system there is that the classes are extremely small. So you might have about 5 to 10 students typically in a classroom. And the teacher is able to really look at the progress of each individual student quite personally.
So after graduating from the ashram, you go to the Indian Institute of Technology to get a master's in physics. Do you remember taking your first test?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have to admit that for the first semester, it was really a struggle for me, switching from never having taken an exam to probably the other extreme of competition in India. In fact, the whole first semester was very difficult.
And then you find yourself in Ithaca, New York, of all places. You left India and went to Cornell to study communications. Do you remember your first impressions of the United States?
I do. I remember just being chaperoned by my fellow student. And he took me sort of around campus, showing things around. Everything was fascinating. But what really caught my attention was that he took me down to the basement of his chemistry department and showed me this box and a machine. And he took out some coins, put it in this machine, and then pressed a button, and down came a can of Coke. And I remember that was so fascinating to me that actually you could get a can of Coke just by, I mean, not even talking to a person.
And do you remember the feeling of cold in Ithaca? I mean, you grew up in Pondicherry where it's like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What was it like to feel Ithaca winters?
I remember the first time I saw snow. In fact, I was 23 years old and it snowed and we were all in a classroom and all of the Indian students left the room, literally, and the professor was wondering what's going on. Mm. And then I also remember when it was really cold, actually I had already started to sport a beard, so my breath would actually freeze on the beard and it was like icicles on the beard. So I remember that as well.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. Bridge, the first time you began to focus on literary issues was, ironically, not in India, but in Ecuador while you were a student at Cornell. How did you first come into contact with those literacy issues in Ecuador?
The project that I did in Ecuador was to actually document the knowledge of medicinal plants of 7 indigenous communities there in the Andes. The issue that we were really concerned was that people were losing their knowledge. The issue of literacy came to the fore then because we realized that even after documenting the knowledge in a written form, it was still not accessible to most people in those communities. So we decided that we would actually represent that written text of the book that we ended up publishing in an iconic form. So every plant remedy and how it was actually used was represented visually. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we found out that even children were able to make, you know, sense of what we had put down visually in print.
Incidentally, you were trying to prevent the disappearance of this knowledge of medicinal plants. Was there any resonance for you because you had studied Ayurvedic medicine at all when you were in India?
Yes, my family in particular is extremely oriented towards Ayurveda and natural remedies. My dad actually eats aloe vera, and he's convinced me to eat aloe vera. And so there are so many things that I just grew up doing at home that were mostly, you know, in the generally the naturopathic realm. So that definitely had an influence. But I think what really influenced me to take this conservation of knowledge issue in Ecuador was really the politics of knowledge, because a lot of knowledge is actually extracted from indigenous communities and that ends up being somewhere else and some other people benefit from it. So our goal was that how can we conserve the knowledge for the people and with the people?
And then how did this interest in knowledge and literacy translate to this idea for same language subtitling, or SLS?
So I spent about 2 years in Ecuador doing this conservation of knowledge, and then I went back to Ithaca to write my dissertation. And typically what you do when you write your dissertation is actually you watch movies to just, you know, procrastinate, really. And so we were 5 or 6 of us just sitting in a room watching Spanish films, and this one in particular happened to be Pedro Almodovar's The Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, hilarious movie. And we were watching this film, and it was the subtitles were in English. So the audio was in Spanish. And at that, I just made a casual comment that why don't they just put Spanish subtitles on a Spanish film? And that way, we would be able to learn Spanish more. And that was our goal at that moment. And actually, if they just put Hindi subtitles on Bollywood film songs, maybe India would become literate. And it was more like a casual comment. I said, well, let me try it out as a research project. And that's how the whole thing started.
It's ironic that you had to be in Ecuador in order to come up with this idea. I guess you're feeling illiterate and you're feeling the need to learn Spanish caused the issue to become more personal in a way.
Right. I totally agree with that. Actually, my interest in learning Spanish had become very, very strong. In fact, to a point where I was a little bit insane, perhaps, to actually label everything at home in Spanish. So everybody, my roommates were like a little irritated that whenever they picked up a knife, it said cuchillo on it. So,
by the way, you grew up in a very literate, well-educated family, but in India, 35% of the population is considered illiterate. So what was your exposure to illiteracy in India when you were growing up?
My mom actually became literate much later in life as an adult. And so I could see shades of literacy even within my family. My dad was totally literate. My mom was semi-literate. Illiteracy was all around us in a way. So there was always this sense that illiteracy is a major issue in India.
And when we say the literacy rate is, we should translate to 65%, how is literacy measured? Is that 65% accurate?
It's not a very accurate measure. What typically they do is a census operator actually shows up to a home in a village and would ask a family to list down all the names and then mark each person on whether they're literate or not based on what one individual in the household actually says. So you end up with people who have, let's say, learned a little bit of the alphabet or learned to basically draw their name, not even write their name, just draw their name. They will call themselves literate. Half the people who are thought of as literate by the census are actually what I would call semi-literate.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. So you came back to India in 1996, where you pursue this SLS idea further, this same language subtitling idea further. How did you get it off the ground initially?
What we would do is, take some, tapes of Bollywood film songs and show them at bus stops, in railway stations, in villages, slums. And what we would do is we'd just plop two televisions, one playing the songs without the subtitles and one playing with the same language subtitles. And we'd ask people to just compare the two and see which one they liked. Almost everybody, over, I would say, 90% or 95% of the people we interviewed actually said that they preferred the songs with the subtitles. So what's happening is that people are getting their reading skills practiced as the words get highlighted, and they really don't know that very consciously. They're not aware of it.
Now, you talk about Bollywood films. For those of us in New York or Washington, D.C. or Texas, we might not have had exposure to Bollywood films. What is a Bollywood film?
Oh, if you haven't seen one, please make it a life ambition to see one. I'm a really passionate Bollywood fan myself. Typically, a Bollywood film will have six songs on average, which would mean that they're really musicals. So it's an industry that has just captivated a large section of the world, I would say, not just in India.
Now, when you talk about just plopping these TVs down in railway stations or bus stops, that seems a little strange to me. I think of Grand Central Station in New York. If you just plop a TV down in the middle of the lobby, people would just run away from it, probably. What is the mindset? Are there people just hanging out around the railway stations just watching this stuff?
I think India, in any place, you could actually create a theater and there would be people just congregating there. Any small incident will get a crowd. And we would get easily 100 to 200 people just gather around the television set. So there was just that. I mean, people have a lot of time on their hands, too.
Because they're not working, perhaps.
Yeah, well, life is slower, generally. And they're waiting for a train or they're getting off a train. It's not like they have to, rush off to some meeting or work. Pace of life is quite slow for most people.
So you have this casual focus group among these people in the railway stations and the bus stops and the villages. How do you then get it on TV? Your first SLS program was on Gujarat State TV, which is Gujarat is one of the states in India. How did that happen?
So after we were convinced that people in the villages liked this idea, we actually did a proper controlled experiment in a low-income school. And we found that the children in grades 3, 4, and 5 who were exposed to the subtitles, their reading improvement was much faster than the group that was not exposed to the songs with the subtitles. Now, based on that study, we thought, now we have the proof. And when we engaged the director at that point of the television station then, he flatly refused. And his hunch was that this, when you add the subtitles to a song-based program, it'll ruin the program. And so it really became his gut feeling versus our data.
How did you get over that?
What we did is we wrote to all the station directors around the country and asked them if they would try this out on any program. And we would pay for the subtitling, but would they just be willing to allow us to try this out? And nobody responded, except one person who happened to be the director of the All India Radio in Gujarat. And unfortunately, he was not the director of the television station. But 3 months later, this guy who wrote back actually ended up becoming the director of the television station in Gujarat State, a total stroke of luck. And he basically said, try this out on television for 3 episodes only. And if the response is good, we'll see. He got calls from a lot of people saying that, wow, you guys are doing wonderful work for literacy.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a karaoke-like service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. How did you fund the project throughout this time?
So we've tapped into a lot of various sources, and we've kind of had a lot of patchwork funding. But then we really got a big break in 2002. We applied to Development Marketplace. It's a global innovation competition at the World Bank with this idea. And we basically asked for the maximum that they would give, which was about $250,000. And to our surprise, actually, we got it. And that really gave us the huge break that we needed to then try and approach national television in Delhi. Of course, even after that, we faced other kinds of hurdles. And I mean, this project has been going on for 11 years now, mm-hmm. and there have been so many hurdles. So for example, there was this ridiculous hurdle, I would say, where one of the directors in the national television program wanted actually our equipment, which was about $50,000, $60,000 of editing equipment. He wanted that in exchange for allowing us to subtitle, even though they were not paying for the equipment. But even then, we told those guys that, okay, you can have the equipment, provided you promise that you're going to continue subtitling on a national television program for 5 years. And they couldn't accept that.
Wow, so you almost succumbed to his ridiculous request.
Yeah, actually, it was a kind of a pretty thought-through succumbing, if I can call it that, because what we knew was the life of the equipment is really about 5 years.
In addition to other challenges you faced, you were having difficulty getting FaceTime with the CEO of TV in India, which is kind of analogous to, I guess, the head of the FCC in the United States. How did you get his attention ultimately?
Getting to this person was not easy. So I sent in word that I really wanted to meet him, and he sort of said that he might be able to see me, but wasn't really sure. So I waited about 5-6 hours literally outside as I saw one executive after another just walk by me, and I couldn't get any time with him. But he kind of knew that I was waiting. So finally he sent word that if I wouldn't mind just taking a ride with him in his car as he went from the television station to his hotel. That was about a 10-minute ride. So I said, great, And then I got into the car with him. I already had my laptop running a Bollywood film song, just turned up the volume and showed it to him. And you won't believe it. He just looked at the idea for literally 15 seconds, didn't say a word, and then said, okay, you come and see me in Delhi because I think we could actually do something with this. And he became one of the strongest supporters of this idea.
Well, thank God for laptops. Do you worry that there might be some pushback that maybe consumers or viewers want the choice to have these words on the bottom of their screen?
What we did in India is actually did like 3-4 surveys to first find out whether even the literate people actually like this idea or not. And what we found is that the popularity among the literate was over 90%. It was just the entertainment and the karaoke effect of subtitling. On the semi-literate, it was both entertainment and reading practice that they valued. And the illiterates also valued, and their support was about 70%. So people were willing to support it pretty much all across.
Now, Bridge, you live in the San Francisco area in Oakland, yet this project is India-based. How do you split your time?
I pretty much spend half the year in India and half the year in the Bay Area in Oakland. What I focus on is policy pushing in India and also fundraising and relationship building in the United States.
How many children do you have?
I have three children, two boys and a girl.
What languages do they speak?
Our children are growing up speaking Hindi, English, of course, and then Portuguese.
Why Portuguese?
So my wife speaks Portuguese and I speak Spanish. And I wanted Spanish, she wanted Portuguese, she won, of course.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.